Okay, good morning, everybody. We'll get started in just a few seconds. Okay, as I mentioned last night, Gimel Elul, the third day of Elul, was the 75th yahrzeit of Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, the first chief rabbi of what was then known as Palestine, and of course a very important figure in 20th century Jewish thought. And while I think everybody has a basic familiarity with Rav Cook, very few people understand the depth of his insights and his activity. And I think there are a lot of misconceptions on Rav Cook, and he was a great halachic authority, not just a thinker and a mystic. So this morning we're going to be addressing some of the issues on Rav Cook. And we're going to start with a intellectual and biographical sketch of his life. And Rabbi Horowitz, who spoke so beautifully last night, will give us an overview of his life. Just to briefly mention, he's a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University, where he's been Rosh Yeshiva for 20 years. He teaches two courses, one in Jewish history, one in philosophy in the college, and has a PhD in Jewish thought on the Ralbag. And it's a pleasure to have him here for the weekend and to be here this morning. So I present Rav Horowitz.
Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. This year, as we know, marks the 75th yahrzeit of Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, first chief rabbi of Israel in modern times. It really is an undeserved honor, even Lageshes El HaKodesh, to come close and speak about this truly great man. With your permission, I'd like to begin with a few personal remarks. I feel that I can talk about Rav Cook, if only a little bit, because I have some family connections on my mother's side. My mother, may she live and be well, was born in Eretz Yisrael during the mandate period when Rav Cook was the chief rabbi. My maternal grandparents, even after arriving in America, kept the picture of Rav Cook in their sukkah. And my mother's mother's father, my great-grandfather, his name was Rav Menachem Mendel Parish of Yerushalayim, Parish family, he was close to Rav Cook, and he figures in several anecdotes about Rav Cook in Simcha Raz's book, An Angel Among Men. Before my grandparents left to America, they made sure that Rav Cook would bless all the children, my mother and her siblings, with a request to God that they remain from the United States of America, and thank God that's what happened. At the outset, I'd also like to mention a truly remarkable PhD from Harvard several years ago that has been written on Rav Cook's early life. It's by a man named Yehuda Mirsky. This work is full of great learning, both deep and wide, and I feel it really pulsates with love of Rav Cook, and it also fills in many lacunae regarding the first 38 years of Rav Cook's life before he made Aliyah. And this is something I'd like to talk about today. We all know that a great person is more than the sum of his influences. But what were Rav Cook's influences? What were the building blocks that made him the great visionary thinker that he was? So I'll be citing Mirsky's work fairly often. Sir Isaiah Berlin famously divided thinkers into hedgehogs and foxes. The hedgehog knows one big thing. The fox knows many things. Rav Cook, one can confidently say, was a fox. First and foremost, he was a halachist. He studied in the yeshiva of Volozhin, which means specifically he was molded in the milieu of Lithuanian Talmudic scholarship. Throughout his adult life, he was a communal rabbi and a halachic decision maker. Moreover, at the same time, he possessed a deep knowledge of the classics of medieval Jewish philosophy, something that many other halachists did not. This, by the way, is one of the points that emerges from Mirsky's dissertation. Rav Cook possessed the command of the Rambam's Mor Nevuchim, Bach Yevim Pakuda's Chovos Halavavos, Rav Yitzchak Arama is Akedat Yitzchak, the works of Maral Prague. He possessed great and wide knowledge of the classic texts of Kabbalah, the Zohar, the particular nuances of the Kabbalah of the Ari, as well as the way the Ari's Kabbalah was reinterpreted by the Ramchal, Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato. So he had so many influences. He even was a Baki in the Lithuanian Kabbalistic tradition, which is based on certain comments of the Gra as they were developed in the 19th century. He also engaged deeply with Hasidic thought and, as we shall see, introduced some elements of Haskalah literature into his worldview as well. So Rav Kook, as Isaiah Berlin would say, was a fox. Moshe Del has distinguished in the medieval period of Jewish history between first-order elites and second-order elites. First-order elites established themselves as masters of Jewish law, the Talmud, and halachic tradition. Now, precisely because of their stature as first-order elites, they could bestow a certain amount of legitimacy for the non-halachic disciplines that they studied. Second-order elites often attained proficiency in these non-halachic areas, but because they were not first-order elites, they could not give to the community at large the positive view of the disciplines that only the first-order elites could. Thus, let us take the dual example of Kabbalists and philosophers, the last two being examples of what late Professor Yitzhak Twersky Zal called meta-halacha. So Rabbi Moses Maimonides, the Rambam, by virtue of being the master halachas that he was, became able to bestow a certain legitimacy on the study of Aristotelian philosophy that other figures who might have been proficient in philosophy but were not master halachists could not do. So Shmuel ibn Tibon, Rav Moshe Narboni, Joseph ibn Kaspi, to mention three medieval Jewish figures who were second-order elites, they were masters of philosophy, but they couldn't give to the community the legitimacy of the study of philosophy that Rambam was able to do because he was a first-order elite. Same thing with respect to Kabbalah. Rabbi Moses Nachmanides, the Ramban, by being a master Talmudic figure, was able to bestow a certain amount of legitimacy to the study of Kabbalah in a sense that his contemporaries and compatriots, figures like the Girona Kabbalists, Rav Ezra of Girona, or Rav Israel of Girona, could not do. So I think it's clear, moving back to Rav Kook, that Moshe Del's distinction between first-order elites and second-order elites applies to Rav Kook as well. And here we come, of course, to another important element of Rav Kook's legacy. Precisely because Rav Kook was a member of the rabbinic first-order elite, as a master Talmudist and halachist. Therefore, his open-mindedness towards various aspects of modernity could strike a chord among Jews who would only follow a certain path if a first-order elite, i.e. a rabbi like Rav Kook, would lead the way. What did Rav Kook read in terms of secular works of learning? Well, from the works that he cites, we can glean what he had read. And we find that he refers to German philosophers such as Kant, Schopenhauer, Nietzsche, as well as figures closer to his time such as the French Bergson. Mirsky points out that he read not only William James and Herman Cohn, but even Charles Dickens. Rav Kook's son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, writes in one letter that I know that the basis of one of my father's essays was an article by Herman Cohn. But how did Rav Kook become acquainted with such literature? So much of his acquaintance was derived secondhand from two sources. First of all, there was the Jewish periodical literature of the time. That was the source. Second, he got this knowledge through what can be called cultural intermediaries. That means the Hebrew writings of figures who themselves had read the German. So one doesn't have to make the claim that if Rav Kook quoted Hegel, he had read the philosophy of right. But he certainly had read Jewish figures who had read the works of the German philosophers in the original and had synthesized and adopted the notions of such figures into their own writings. So, for example, two famous cultural intermediaries would be Nachman Krochmal, the 19th century author of Mor Nevuchei HaZman, and David Newmark, who wrote his own slightly idiosyncratic, but his own view of the entire gamut of Jewish philosophy. So Rav Kook got to know the thoughts of these thinkers. And he didn't reject everything. He affirmed key elements by absorbing some intellectual aspects of modernity while being at the same time absolutely unimpeachable in its personal observance of all the rules and regulations of halacha. Moreover, as I already mentioned, Rav Kook was steeped in not just the nigle of Talmud Torah, Shas and Poskim, but the nistar also, Kabbalah. And because Rav Kook was a first-order elite, his espousal of various aspects of modernity, and eventually his strong identification with the Jewish nationalist movement in Israel that found expression Aliyah Bet at the beginning of the 20th century, could not be ignored. And therefore, his orientation gained legitimacy among Orthodox Jews who otherwise would have been hesitant. But we're not finished. A fox knows many different things. Rav Kook was a poet. He wrote works on Agadata, the non-halachic sections of Talmud. And he took his lyrical gifts and used them to proclaim the glory of Jewish rituals, to proclaim his yearning for God, and to heighten and intensify his own halachic observance. His mystical overtones led him to see even greater heights in the study of Torah and in the words of Torah themselves, as well as in the mitzvot that emerge from the words of the Torah. There's a remarkable English biography of Rav Kook written over 60 years ago, in 1946, by Jacob Agus. It's entitled Banner of Jerusalem. And just by looking at the various titles that he calls Rav Kook in his biography, you can see many of the dimensions of Rav Kook. Rav Kook is called the Orthodox Achad HaAm. Achad HaAm, of course, was not from at all, but he believed in the Jewish people. Agus calls Rav Kook the High Priest of Rebirth, and he calls him the Defender of the Faith. Rav Kook was all three. Rav Kook said, as there are laws in poetry, there's poetry and laws. To Rav Kook, as Agus says, the rituals of Judaism related to piety as rhythm and rhyme are related to poetry. Through these self-imposed limitations on expressions, the spirit of piety attains its highest concentration. So Rav Kook was makbid on every jot and tittle of halacha, but through his observance of the halacha, he saw magnificent worlds, and this made him closer to God. Jacob Agus translates a poem of Rav Kook, which goes as follows. Even through these constricted channels, whence contentment fills my being, I delight in sweetness divine. I glimpse the pure ideal will, mysterious, hidden, mighty, suffusing letters, even tittles, all problems and pilpuls, and I rejoice in your commands that I love, and I converse in your love. Let us now move to some actual facts about Rav Kook's life. Avram Yitzchak was the eldest child of Rav Shlomo Zalman Peres Lata Kook. He was born in 1865, September 7th, the 16th day of Elul. He was born in Griva, that is in the Kurland province of Latvia. He was named Avram for his maternal grandfather, and Yitzchak for a paternal ancestor who was an early follower of Hasidim. And as a child, his parents are recorded as having playfully debated whether their child grew up to be a Lithuanian Talmud Chacham or a Hasidic Rebbe. So he already had more than one way of looking at reality as a child. Griva was a suburb of a town called Dagopils, known in Yiddish as Dvinsk. Later, this was the seat of two very famous rabbis, Rabbi Meir Simcha Cohen Katz, the author of Or Sameach and the Rambam, and Joseph Rosen, known as the Rugachover. Coeur d'Alene, although it's part of the area which we call Litha, which of course entailed not just Lithuania, but Latvia and Belarus also, it was an interesting place because even though it was primarily a Mishnagdic area, namely an area which had the descendants of those who opposed the Hasidus, there were some Hasidim in Coeur d'Alene also. And of course, since it was in the southwest part of Latvia, it was not that far from Volozhin, so the yeshiva of Volozhin had a pull also. Rav Kook was very proud of his ancestry. His mother's uncle, Rav Mordechai Gimpel Yaffa, was a rabbi of various small cities, an alumnus of Volozhin, and descendant of the Lavush. The Lavush was also named Rav Mordechai Yaffa. He was in the 16th century, wrote a book that was intended to be an alternative for Ashkenazic Jewry to the Ramah in his comments on the Shulchan Aruch. It didn't really succeed, but the Lavush was a very great halachist who also wrote on non-halachic topics. So I think that's a fascinating point to ponder. Rav Kook, in his pride in his heritage, was a descendant of those whose expression of Jewish thought was not just limited to halacha. His mother's uncle was known as a moderate Orthodox maskil, and later he became a significant figure in proto-Zionist circles. He eventually settled in Israel. I'm talking about his mother's uncle, Rav Mordechai Yaffa, and he even authored a super commentary on Ramban al Torah. Some of the early accounts of Rav Kook's life match those of all Talmudic tragedies. They're so brilliant, the parents don't know what to do with him, so he must go and study somewhere. Same thing with Rav Kook, but what you have in Rav Kook is a fascinating melange of influences. At the age of 9, he went to study with Rav Reuven Levin, the Misnagid rabbi of Dvinsk. Rav Levin was Talmud of someone named Yehuda Leib Shapiro, who was a Talmud not only of Rav Chaim of Volozhiner, the legendary founder of the Volozhin Yeshiva, but of the idiosyncratic Menashe of Ilya. Menashe of Ilya was a student of the Vilna Gaon, who had some critical perspectives to the study of Talmud, and sometimes interpreted Mishnayos, what he felt would be kipshuto, the plain meaning of the Mishnah, even if it didn't really fit with what the Gemara said. So already you see how this young genius is being influenced by all these different currents. And there is some evidence that this Rav Levin, the early Rebbe of Rav Kook, had studied for a time in his youth with Menashe of Ilya himself. Rav Kook's apprenticeship with Rav Levin lasted until he was 15. Rav Kook often recounted how Rav Levin said that one should, in study, give primary attention to the text of the Talmud, the text of the Gemara, the words of the Rishonim, the medieval authorities, and should not devote one's primary efforts to conceptual reformulations in halacha. This is fascinating because for all Rav Kook's innovations in halacha, he adopted the method of the Netziv of Volozhin and not the method of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. In other words, in halacha, he was more of a pashtun. He was not interested in setting up, brisker conceptual substructures. At the age of 15, Rav Kook moved on. He went to Ludza, it's a Latvian town, where the rabbi was named Rav Eliezer Don Yechaya. This family was associated with a Babich. There was no yeshiva here. The Rav simply sat in the Beis Medrash and taught the students. So this brilliant 15-year-old, who already has a lot of influences, is now becoming the student of someone who made a habit of not just teaching halacha, but agadata, the non-halachic, the non-legal portions of the Talmud as well. He taught works such as Ein Yaakov. He taught works as Menorah HaMa'or, a medieval ethical tract. And he taught medieval philosophers such as Rav Yosef Albo and Maharal. And indeed, it may be here that the young Avram Yitzchak first encountered the works of the Maharal that he grew to love. Another teacher of the young Avraham Yitzchak was his father's first cousin, a man named Yaakov Rabinowitz. Rav Kook later recalled that whereas Rav Don Yechia taught him bekius in many texts, simply knowledge of the halachic parts of the Talmud, knowledge of the non-legal parts of the Talmud, Yaakov Rabinowitz taught him bi'iyun. Rabinowitz was another example of what can be called a religious maskil, meaning that although they were scrupulous in their observance of Jewish law, but they also accepted certain new perspectives of the modern world. He loved Tanakh. Yaakov Rabinowitz had a large library with lots of works of Wissenschaft. Now, when we study figures at the end of the 19th century like Rav Kook, certain scholars developed this idea called the maskilic tutor. In other words, people during their teenage years or during their early 20s would have an older figure, whether it is an uncle, an older relative, and even an older friend, who would introduce a young scholar to various aspects of Haskalah, but to guide him that his absorption of these works should not force him to fall off the cliff and leave Orthodox Judaism. So this Yaakov Rabinowitz can be characterized as one of Rav Kook's maskilic tutors. And remarkably, and this seems to have come from inside, Rav Kook started to write poetry at this age. Even at this time, anecdotes began to swirl about the young man that entailed his piety, his prodigious capacity for study, and his heightened emotional sensibility. In fact, his extreme personal piety was, according to some accounts, even evidence when he was still in his parents' house. Jacob Agus, in his biography of Rav Kook, recounts the following story. The 9-year-old prodigy returned home from the Beis Medrash with scratches on his face. His parents wondered what happened. They knew he was not given to fist fights. They questioned him and discovered that their son would cover his eyes with his hands whenever he would see a woman approaching, and at times would stick nails into his skin to eliminate all sexual thoughts from his mind. Agus himself says that one cannot vouch for the accuracy of the story. It may be only a legend. So here we have the methodological point. What does one do when one hears a legend like this? So let me digress for a moment and tell you what my wife's mother said. My mother-in-law, when she is challenged for the veracity of a legend, would say, well, they wouldn't say it about you. In other words, the issue is not whether this story is true or not per se. The point is that even as a young age, Rav Kook was known as a tzaddik. That's the point. And this helps us understand why Rav Kook's vision became so compelling to so many people, because they saw he wasn't a phony. He was a first-order elite, not only in halacha, but he was a first-order elite in terms of personal piety. His tolerance for Jews flowed from a character that was not only morally and religiously absolutely unimpeachable, but indeed was capable of almost superhuman extremes of piety. At the age of 18, went to Smorgon, a city in Lithuania. Local rabbi there, his name was Chaim Avram Shapiro Volozhin. He provided him with room and board and offered his own son-in-law as a study partner. This Rav Shapiro's brother was more famous. Rav Chaim Avram Shapiro's brother was Rav Rafal Shapiro, who was the son-in-law of the Netziv and the father-in-law of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik of Brisk. It was here in Smorgon that Rav Kook started to add another element to his remarkable worldview, Musar literature. Various anecdotes from this point in his life record his adoption of the teachings of Yisrael Salanter. His student, Rav Yaakov Moshe Chalak, records Rav Kook telling him that when he heard of Rav Yisrael Salanter's passing, he rent his own clothes as a sign of mourning. In 1884, Rav Kook already was getting a certain name in Lithuania. he returned home. He attracted the attention of Rabbi Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Taomim, known by his acronym, the Aderet. The Aderet was a rabbi who had a horribly, almost incomprehensible, bitter life. 9 of his 13 children died at young ages. He was searching for a shidduch for his youngest daughter. He heard of the young Avraham Yitzchak Cook. They met in Riga, capital of Latvia, that summer. They hit it off with each other, and Rav Cook did meet the girl before they were betrothed. After he got engaged, he went to the yeshiva in Volozhin with the understanding that the marriage would take place in a year. So when he came to Volozhin, he already had so many different influences already. In other words, you want to know, how is a person formed? It didn't happen yesh me'ayin, it didn't happen magically. Rather, there was, as we discussed, his parents, you have the Hasidic element, the Misnagid element, then you have the Maskilic tutors, and then you have the Muster element, and then you have the poetic nature, and it's all being forged. The next stop was in Volozhin. He became the disciple of the Netziv, Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, the dean, and as I mentioned already, he preferred the Netziv's approach to Talmudic study as opposed to the conceptual approach of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik. Mirsky, in his dissertation, points out something fascinating. Although the overwhelming majority of students of Volozhin were of Lithuanian and Misnagid background, stemming from the opponents of Hasidim, there were a few Hasidim in Volozhin. One of them was his Chavrusa. Fascinatingly, another student of Hasidic background who was in Volozhin at the same time with Rav Kook was Micha Yosef Berdichevsky. He was a son of a Hasidic Rebbe, and when he was in Volozhin, he wore talis and tefillin all day. Eventually, of course, these are the rumors at least, eventually, of course, he left traditional Judaism, and he argued for a complete transformation of values of Judaism. He was even against Achad HaAm's championing the ethical elements of Judaism. Micha Yosef Budachevsky said, we have become Jewish Nietzscheans. Now, Mirsky points out something astounding. If you look at the path of Rav Kook's life and you look at the path of Berdichevsky's life, there's a certain parallel. But the difference is, in Berdichevsky, the new elements that he absorbed caused a rupture, a total break with his previous adherence to traditional Judaism. Rav Kook, on the other hand, was just able to absorb everything he learned and forge it into an overarching, unified world picture. Volozhin, Rav Avraham Yitzchak, distinguished himself by his piety. Most of the students of Volozhin were clean-shaven. He had a beard. He would put a sign near his shtender, Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Samid, I set God before me at all times. And he spoke in Hebrew. It's not clear where this came from, but at a certain point, Rav Kook said, this is the language that I'm going to speak with other human beings. He was known as the Eloi from Dvinsk. Gryv was a suburb of Dvinsk. And not everyone in Volozhin went for him. Some of the other students disapproved of his behavior. This vein, I recall a conversation I had almost 30 years ago with a fierce anti-Zionist. He told me that from his prominent family, he had heard that in Volozhin, Rav Kook was referred to as the Bacham mit Meshugana Eigen, the young man with the crazy eyes. By the way, Rav Kook was cross-eyed. Jacob Agus writes that in his book, and in some of the pictures you can see it. In my opinion, this Volozhin comment probably was a cruel attempt at some pop physiognomy by those that didn't like him. But it didn't disturb him. Rav Kook had that remarkable self-assurance that comes with someone that knows he has put it all together and he is following his path to the Ribono Shel Olam. Rav Kook married Batsheva Rabinowitz Taomim, the Deretz daughter, in 1886. He resumed his learning there with his father-in-law. But the next year, he already became a communal rabbi, 1887, young man of 22. Why? Many accounts, such as that of Jacob Agus, stress the influence of a meeting he had with the Chafetz Chaim, who urged the young genius to begin using his prodigious talents to help his people. Mirsky, that may be true, but Mirsky points out another factor. His father-in-law was extremely poor. They were in dire financial straits, so he had to make a living. Rav Kook's first position was in Zaimel, Lithuanian town near the border from Latvia. He was there for 8 years. It was in Zaimel that he first started publishing. You know, the Rambam writes in Moreh Nevuchim about different levels of prophecy, and he writes an early stage is you just have this burning desire to share what you have received intellectually with other people, so you write it down and you disseminate it. And I think we can see this burning desire of Kook as well. His first two articles concerned the Netziv. First, he defended the Netziv against an anonymous attacker who criticized the Netziv for showing too much independence of Chazal in his biblical commentary. If everyone reads the Hamik Davar, you'll see that the Netziv has his own shavtim, his own interpretations sometime. So apparently, again, this is the end of the 19th century, someone said, how dare the Netziv do this? So Rav Kook, burning with Avas Yisrael, and certainly burning with Ava for his teacher, the Netziv, wrote a strong article defending his Rebbe. Then he wrote a profile of the Netziv for a journal called Knesset Yisrael. What is fascinating here is that this journal included profiles of various rabbinic figures of a maskilic bent. In his early 20s, Rav Kook now embarked on a new project. He wanted to And he began, actually, to publish a monthly periodical called Itra Sofrim. Now, it's important to recognize what can be called the burgeoning journalistic and periodical culture of the time. You know, this is the end of the 19th century. Jews are being exposed to all different ideas. You have these cultural intermediaries that are bringing German philosophy, French philosophy, the ideas of socialism and nationalism and so much going on in the world. How does a Jew get these ideas? The journals were key elements of this cultural expression. Rav Kook wanted to be an Orthodox figure getting involved in this. Now, it's fascinating. We have two issues of this, Itra Sofrim, and in one of those issues, Rav Kook says that we have to have a more systematic notion of halachic laws and responsa. Now, one of Rav Kook's disciples was a man named Binyamin Menashe Levin. And of course, after Rav Kook died, Binyamin Menashe Levin edited the magisterial Otzar HaGaonim. And he was a Talmud of Rav Kook from Europe. And indeed, the whole Talmudic Encyclopedia project can be seen as an expression of an idea that Rav Kook had, bringing it to fruition. But again, as a fox, as I keep on mentioning, Rav Kook had so many different ideas at the same time, it's truly astounding. And in one of his essays, his Itza Sofrim, he discusses the nature of prophecy. He tries his hand at answering the old question dealt by the Rambam, the Moreh Nevuchim, and others, to what extent is prophecy a purely natural phenomenon, the result of a person's intellectual attainment? To what extent is prophecy a gift from God? This is a great example of his interest, his burning interest and involvement in meta-halachic concerns, even at a young age. But only two issues of Itza Sofrim were ever published. In the spring of 1889, his wife died at the age of 22. At his father-in-law's urging, he remarried his wife's cousin, the daughter of the Aderet's twin brother. Second wife's name was Reza Rivka. At this point, there's a certain turning inward of Rav Kook. He made a pilgrimage to the Mekubal Rav Shlomo Elyashiv, author of the work Lechem Shvav Achalma, the father of the Rav Elyashiv, who is still alive in Israel. For the next 12 years, Rav Kook apparently turned inward and published publicly next to nothing. He did a lot of writing, but he was forging himself, dealing, I'm sure, with the death of his wife, the fact that he was now in the Rabbanus, which he couldn't devote all his energies towards his own personal dvekus with God, so he was reforging himself. He privately composed a commentary to the fantastic Agadita, the Talmudic legend of Baba Basra. This is a passage which details the seafaring adventures of Rabbi Bar Chana. This was only printed in 1984 in the volume called Mamorei HaRaya. Now, it's a tradition since the beginning of the Gaonic period that we do not take these stories literally. These are stories about the monsters and Leviathan and everything that's going on in his sea voyages. So what does it mean? So Rav Kook gave his own interpretation of many of these legends. And I think it's fascinating to see that, I believe at least, that he is really viewing himself as the Rabbi Bar Chana character. Let me give an example. One of the tales is a beach near the sea, which turns out to be the back of a dangerous monster, Leviathan. What does this mean? Rav Kook said it refers to a man who has attained such intellectual perfection that he's able to, on the one hand, converse with other people about earthly matters, and at the same time have tzevekus with God. This, of course, makes one think of the magnificent concluding chapters of the Gai, 351, where the Rambam depicts this type of person. But, Rav Kook adds, attractive as this figure is, the danger lies in his inimitability. Only he can do it. He cannot be the source of emulation for students or inferiors. I think Rav Kook at this point was seeing himself as a member of the spiritual elite. And this fits in with his practice when he was Rabbi Zaymel. He himself studied the Mor Nevuchim intensely, but he did discourage others that he felt were not prepared to do so. In Zaymel, he began many other projects. And here we find something interesting. You know, the Talmud tells us no person dies without even having more than half of his dreams unfulfilled. So Rav Kook, whose mind was so fertile, started a lot of projects he never finished. Talmudic commentary to Maseches Chulin, a super commentary on the Vilna Gaon's Bir Hagra, a commentary of his own on the Shulchan Aruch called Mitzvah Riyah. And I would say probably one of the most fascinating tracts he wrote at this time was Chovesh Pe'er, 1891, published this anonymously. This is regarding the mitzvah of tefillin and the proper way to observe it. Now, you know, people have this misconception of Rav Kook. They think because he was, you know, he saw the value of the pioneers of Aliyah Bet, well, he'd be a halachic makil. That's a very superficial understanding. You read Chovesh Pe'er, Rav Kook is so strict about the exact place you must put the tefillin. He said you cannot put it on the forehead. It has to be, again, further up, the roots of the hair. And if you do it the wrong way, you are missing the whole point of the mitzvah and you're losing out on all the Kabbalistic benefits. He stressed tefillin's connection with the mind, and the mind as the intellect. The Rambam says, Tzelem Elokim, when man is created in the image of God, it means that God gives man an intellect with which he can imitate God. Therefore, the tefillin has to be connected with that. So, I think it's important to take a minute to realize the anomaly of this tract within the social currents of the time. This is the 1890s. People that were leaving the shtetl were not necessarily concerned about where they put tefillin. They were, God forbid, ready to throw their tefillin to the ocean, which is what many emigrants to America did the minute they saw the Statue of Liberty. To be sure, one can see, even from the Gemara, a unique mystical association of tefillin with a religious experience. But Rav Kook knew that the Amcha was not interested in that, but yet he still sought to apply the fruits of his own spirituality towards anyone that would listen, even if people would not have fully appreciate what he was doing. Rav Kook, as I mentioned, from his first wife, had one daughter. The second wife, he had three children, including one son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, who was born in 1891. After Rav Kook and his second wife made Aliyah, by the way, one of his daughters, at the age of 12, fell down a flight of stairs, died instantly, and it's terrible. He also composed an elegy for his first wife, and he was still growing, moving back to 1890s during these years. In 1896, he became Rav of a town called Boisk. There was the previous rabbi there was Mordechai Eliasberg, who was also not just a friend of his former father-in-law, but a leading figure in Chibat Zion, the proto-religious Zionist movement, alumnus of Volozhin. So it seems this rabbi Eliasberg was another model for Rav Kook. In these years, Rav Kook also, not excessively, but a little bit, got involved in the Musa controversy. It's the briefest of summaries. The 1890s, there was a big debate regarding the curriculum of the yeshivas. Should they maintain a Gemara-only curriculum, or should they entail the study of Musa texts as developed, not just by Rav Saul Salanter, but his students, such as of Simcha Zissel of Kelm. Both Rav Kook and his father-in-law came out for the study of Musar. Interestingly, in 1903, right before he came to Israel, Rabbi Eliezer Gordon, then the dean of Tel Yeshiva, offered Rav Kook the position of instructor of Jewish thought in Musar. Rav Kook turned it down, but he did present to Rav Gordon what he feels the yeshiva's curriculum should be. And I think it's important just to mention it. He says it should have Tanakh, Medrash, Zohar, Rav Yehuda Levi's Kuzari, Tzadik Gaon's Emunos V'Deos, Rambam's Shmoneh Prokhim, Bachya's Chovos HaLevavos. Why did he turn the position down? The easiest explanation is because at this point he was already planning to go to Israel, and Israel beckoned to much greater spiritual heights. But there is one legend quoted by Rav Nathan Kamenetsky, the author of a book called The Making of a Gadol. Rav Kook used to help his wife Erev Shabbos, and some of the people there, whether it was Rav Gordon himself or other people in Telz, felt this is unbecoming, new mashgiach to go helping your wife in the kitchen. So the offer was rescinded. But obviously, again, whether that story is true or not, you see Rav Kook felt that he would do what he feels is right. He didn't bow to the conventions of smaller people. Rav Kook arrived in Yafo 1904. His father-in-law was there already. First father-in-law. He arrived on Chav Ches Iyar. Here I can't resist pointing out what Rav Tzvi Yehuda said. Chav Ches Iyar, that was the day we captured the Kotel. So Rav Kook, I get very emotional. You read about Tzvi Yehuda, you see so many things in his father's life that it's, man is concept, it's a pattern-seeking animal. So we see that he came to Israel, Chav Ches Iyar, and they recapture the Kotel on Chav Ches Iyar many years later. Now, in Israel, of course, he wrote famous works praising the Chalutzim. I know I'll have to... Can't really get into all this now. He published a book called Eitz Hadar, arguing for the superiority of Esrog from Israel. By the way, big machmir. Rav Kook came out strongly against any grafted Esrogim. 1909-1910 was the big year, the Shemitah year, in which Rav Kook said, I see the truth as I see it, and therefore the pioneers can work the land with the Heter Mechira. During World War I, I'm going very quickly now, he was in Europe. He got stuck in Europe during World War I. He came to Switzerland, then England, and he was able to influence many people in England to have the Balfour Declaration signed. And at one point, there was some very assimilationist British Jews who were big anti-Zionists. So the story, the MP said, who is more of a Jew? These people who are running away from their heritage or this Rabbi Cook? For a Tzvi Yehuda adds something else. At the time of World War I, there was a delegation of German Jews from the Aguda who were also planning to convince the British government not to go forward with the Balfour Declaration. But they couldn't get in because they were from Germany. Germany was the other side during World War I. So Tzvi Yehuda points out, you know, these British MPs who didn't know much about Judaism, they saw that Rav Kook with his shtreimel looks more Jewish than someone that, you know, eats ham and eggs every day and, you know, doesn't look Jewish, but they might not have seen the distinction between Rav Kook and these German Jews. Rav Tzvi Yehuda says it was all part of the hashgacha that Dafka, my father, Avraham Yitzchak, should have been there in World War One. Rav Kook tried to rise above the fray in the Orthodox Jewry at all times. He had this plan, which never worked out, to merge, instead of having the Mizrahi party and the Aguda party, have a party called Degel Yerushalayim. But unfortunately, like so many plans, it didn't come to fruition. 1924, he already became chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. First he was in Yafo, then he became chief rabbi of Yerushalayim. 1924, he visited North America. He came to America, even came to Canada, Montreal though, but not Toronto. He pointed out to the people in Montreal that you, like I, are a British subject. By the way, my great-grandfather was one of the people who tried to fight the Tanaim from the old Yishuv who did not want Rav Kook to become Rav of Yerushalayim. Rav Kook was deeply pained by the Hebron massacres. And we have a lot of 1929. And I think from the last 6 years of his life was very hard. You know, 1920, Rav Kook wrote an essay which he honestly thought that the Jewish state could be established peacefully. I think already 1929, he saw that it's going to be very, very difficult. He was full of wrath at the British government for not really capturing and punishing the murderers of the Jews in Hebron. He also fought bitterly against attempts by the Arab authorities who at one point convinced the British not to let the Jews put chairs near the Kotel. And there was big fights on that issue. Then, slowly but surely, his health started to diminish. He suffered very badly from cancer during the last years of his life. In 1935, the Rav, by the way, Rav Soloveitchik, when he went to Eretz Yisrael, he met Rav Kook and met him twice. The second time he read, Rav Kook was in the hospital. And the Rav said he had a conversation with Rav Kook about what to do on Yom Tov Sheni. As you can imagine, Rav Kook was a very strong believer that you really can't be what's called Daito Lachzor. If you are in Israel and you're thinking clearly, you want to stay in Israel, which would lead you to the position that you should only observe one day of Yontif, even if you're from Chutz Laaretz in Israel, that's another conversation. 1935, his health diminished, and the third day of Elul, tough, Reish, Sadi Hay, September 1st, 1935, Rav Kook died. Tzvi Yehuda pointed out that it was 16 years to the day, Gimel Elul, that Rav Kook first set foot in Yerushalayim in his prologue to becoming the Rav of the city. In his eulogy, and I'll end with this, Menachem Mendel Yisishkin, the head of the Jewish National Fund, said the following story. A group of pietists once asked the chief rabbi, how could he possibly approve the immigration to the Holy Land of irreligious secular youths who are desecrating the sacred land by their transgression? In answer, the chief rabbi said, the most sacred part of Palestine in ancient times was the Holy of Holies, the Kodesh Kodashim in the temple. Only the high priest was permitted to enter that party of the temple, and even he would do so only on Yom Kippur. And the high priest had to undergo a series of purifications in order to be rendered fit to enter the Holy of Holies. On the other hand, if repairs were needed in the temple, no obstacles were placed on the part of the artisans, they and their assistants, even if they're a Tomei, even if they were impure, were allowed to enter the Holy of Holies. Why? To fix the Beis HaMikdash, to institute the repairs. So too, Rav Kook said, we are now in the presence of building the Holy Land. It needs repair. We need working men with their rough and energy, their gusto and their boldness. The Chalutzim are these working men. Later, with God's help, when there will be a Jewish commonwealth in Israel, then there will be the time for the application of the strict standards of piety, and he was sure that eventually all Jews will indeed achieve this level of piety. Thank you very much.